Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we'll have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, it's not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website at www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to listen to prior shows, the most recent five, the last five, are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com, and the rest of them, all of the shows that we've done, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks for coming. Okay, now let's get started. Now, this show, our topic is going to be expectations. When we start a negotiation, a seminar, some sort of consensus building, the question, I think the first question we're going to talk about is, do we start with an expectation concerning the outcome? Do we come with an expectation? Do we have it in our mind exactly what's going to happen and how it's going to happen probably too? And so that'll be our initial question. Oh, I see lots of people are already participating. Thank you very much for coming. Now, this is interesting. I always say I learn something during these shows, and I hope you do too. And I have quite a few people that are saying no, that they do not start any kind of a mediation, a negotiation, whatever it is that we are doing, a workshop, a seminar. They do not start with an expectation. In fact, they try not to. They try not to start with an expectation at all. And as James is saying, then I'm not disappointed. Well, that's an interesting point. And that would be if you were kind of had a very high expectation that maybe wasn't realistic. For example, quite a few people are voting this way. How interesting. Elizabeth says, you cannot have any opinion or expectation concerning the outcome until you're halfway through. You know, that's a good point. It is then a very realistic and practical one, and a lot of people are agreeing with Elizabeth that you cannot have any opinion or expectation concerning the outcome until you're halfway through, because then, of course, you have, and other people are saying this too, thank you very much for all of your participation, then you have an idea, a practical, realistic idea of how things are going, of the opinions of the various people and how they are interacting. And, you know, that's a very good point. And it's a good idea in that respect not to have a particular expectation, although I see a lot of people are saying that it can't be avoided. But James says that you need to understand the people and the issues before forming expectations. And those are very good points. And I do agree, of course, and I think we can all agree that it would be perhaps beneficial to not particularly form an expectation until we're somewhat into the process, until we can have a realistic idea of what's going to happen, of what the issues are, of what the complexity is. And you know, a lot of people are disagreeing with me, and please do. This is what this forum is for. And they're saying that if you don't come with an expectation, then you won't be able to lead properly because you won't know where you're going. And, you know, that is, well, is an expectation really the idea of where we're going? I think it is, don't you? Yes, I'm getting a lot of agreement that the expectation is looking forward to what we hope the outcome will be. And a lot of people are saying that they always go with an expectation concerning the outcome, because how else will you have focus? I would have said yes to the question, basically, because whenever I do a mediation, negotiation, seminar, workshop, whatever we're doing, I usually do have rather an outline, not necessarily on a piece of paper, but maybe in my head an idea of where I think we should try to go together, the path we should take, and what we should focus on. And I think in order to do that, I do come with an expectation, and my expectation is always that we will succeed, that we will get to the final outcome, that we will reach consensus and get a work product, so to speak, and get an outcome that we can all agree upon, and we will go forward. That's my expectation. And people are saying that that's sometimes an unreasonable expectation. That's true. And it is a point that perhaps it might be less discouraging to not come with an expectation at all, to just come as a blank slate. And people are actually advocating that. They say that if you come with an expectation as to the exact outcome and the exact success and what that means, especially in a fairly complex consensus gathering, you will be disappointed. And this is true, I think, if you are going to be somewhat, I hate to use the word inflexible, but somewhat set in your expectation. Because even if you come with an expectation, it can change somewhat. Now, can't it? And Paul says that humans always have expectations because otherwise you cannot formulate goals. That's an interesting point. Humans, that's all of us, right? Always have expectations because otherwise you cannot formulate goals. See, he's saying, basically speaking, that your expectation is your ultimate goal, right? And he's agreeing, yes. Your expectation is the goal that you have in mind for the outcome. Mm-hmm. And it's a good point. In fact, we might, you know, some of the people that voted no, that they don't come with expectations, are now saying they voted no because they did not particularly visualize an expectation as a goal, just a general goal. They visualized it more as a specific expectation concerning a specific and very, very, very specific and very formulated outcome. Yes, they're saying that a goal is a more general thought than an expectation. And I suppose that's true, but an expectation does kind of lead to a goal, according to quite a few people that have agreed with Paul. And I think maybe that's true, that if you have an expectation towards the outcome, then you have formulated a goal. And, you know, this is an interesting point. We've spoken before about self-fulfilling prophecies, haven't we? And that if you think something will be, you kind of work your way towards making it occur. And if you, by your actions and by your thoughts, and you work towards making it occur, and also a self-fulfilling prophecy can be negative, that if you feel that something is going to fail, you will kind of work it around so that it does. That's at least the theory of self-fulfilling prophecies. We've talked about them before. And Arnold says that expectations create a self-fulfilling prophecy. If it's negative, then the outcome will not be successful. And, well, yeah, I suppose that's goals and expectations and other things, and I'm getting quite a bit of agreement with Arnold's opinion, that goals and expectations do indeed create a self-fulfilling prophecy to a certain extent. Although, in past shows, and of course, did I mention that they are archived? The last five are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com, Every show that we've done, well, most of them, are archived on the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. And I believe there actually is a show called Self-Fulfilling Prophecy. But we tend to think of self-fulfilling prophecy as a less conscious act, as something that we haven't really formulated, but just kind of is in the back of our mind and something that we feel as in a belief, really. And that an expectation and a goal setting are more concrete and more definite and a more conscious act. And so, yes, they can become a self-fulfilling prophecy, of course, but we're focusing on something we might even have written down. And I see that a lot of you actually are telling me that you do write down the goals and expectations at the first meeting. What an interesting thought. You know, that's a real theory to keep the group focused. Quite a few people are telling me that when they hold the first get-together, the first meeting, for whatever it is they're trying to resolve and get consensus on, that they actually break out a whiteboard, something to write on, and the host, the leader, whoever's been nominated because they have the best handwriting, actually writes down what the group sees as the ultimate goal and expectation when they get done, when they have reached consensus, when they have resolved the issues between them. It is written down as a template, as an idea, as a guide, so that we know where we're going and what the goals are that we wish to achieve. And that is a very practical, very time-honored tradition to do that. And I think perhaps, and I'm getting some people talking about this, perhaps it is that kind of a setting down in writing is the most valuable in a smallish group setting because you can agree better and because you have to rather agree on these goals. You don't want to get bogged down for hours on formulating the goals and expectations and writing them down in the wording. And it is best if the issues are not too numerous and not so complex that you can't really write this down with some simplicity. You see, goals have to be attainable, expectations and goals have to be attainable and practical, which is basically attainable, and something that we can agree upon. And the final outcome, you don't want to have a fight over what the final outcome will be until you've decided amongst you what it is, if it's a very complex set of issues. What you want to do about it, about whatever is wrong, is sometimes a more judgmental and a more argumentative. In fact, people are saying that sometimes that causes a great deal of dissension immediately in the group, and then the group refuses to go forward and disbands. So you got to be careful about that. In fact, I'm seeing quite a few people that tell me they've had that experience, that when they really try to set things down on paper, so to speak, when they write down and try to get a consensus as to the wording of where we're going on the very first, whenever we first meet, sometimes I see a lot of people are saying that they've had the experience where that will cause that will prevent a second meeting. That will cause the people to get discouraged right away or to argue with each other. So it is an excellent tool, an excellent idea, but it needs to be used with some discretion, depending on the group, depending on how many people, depending on how many issues, and depending on the complexity. If the tool is used well, then you have gotten quite far in your first meeting, right? Because you've already got a consensus of where you're going. And everyone has gotten a feel for what everyone else thinks. And you hopefully will be closer together than you thought you might be. Or else it's interesting, too, to to know where the differences lie. So, yes, that is a very excellent idea and a very good way of to write down your expectations for the outcome on the first time that you meet. Actually take them and write them down and talk about them. If it's the, yeah, I know, I'm going to say it depends again. People are going, you're going to say it depends. Yes, I am. I get accused of doing this quite a bit. People send emails and I go, you always say it depends. You never actually answer. But it does. It depends on your judgment of what it is you're trying to accomplish and who the people are and how far apart they are. You see, because you don't want to scare them off on the first, you don't want to scare them off on the first date yet, at the first meeting, but you don't want, but it is an excellent focus tool to write down the goals and expectations. It's a very good point. And so now I've got quite a few people that are telling me that they don't come with expectations because they change, that you can't start out with an expectation of what's going to happen because life changes. And so I think that our next question that we're going to consider is, do expectations change the negotiation process? Let's say that we come with an expectation of what we're going to do, what our ultimate goal is, the path that we're going to take. Let's say that we even write it down in our first meeting and everybody pretty much agrees to a general goal, a general idea of what we would like. How we'll get there is why we're getting together, right? But what we would want the ultimate outcome to be may be discernible as an expectation and a goal right away, because otherwise we wouldn't be getting together. But even if we write it down, can the expectations and goals change? And I'm getting quite a few people that say yes, of course. As you go forward, the expectations must change. For example, Robin says that they become modified to fit the situation, but so that you don't become negative or positive, right? But they still remain negative and positive. I'm sorry. I was reading your email incorrectly. I'm sorry, Ron. Your expectations become modified to fit the situation, but they still remain either negative or positive. That's an interesting point about a negative expectation. I think, and I'm getting some people that say they never start with a negative expectation because a negative expectation is failure, right? That it won't work. That's the ultimate negative expectation. I think that all expectations and goals can be thought of and worded and worked towards as a positive, and that it will be less confusing for the group and more straightforward as a goal setting to have a positive expectation or goal and not a negative one. You know, even if the negative one is not failure of this particular group, this particular idea, but that something else will fail and cause us to rise is still a negative expectation, a negative expectation. I think even if that's true, that when something fails, we will succeed, that it should be thought of and worded in a positive manner, because it will lead towards better goal setting, better focusing. That's actually my preference. I see that a lot of people are saying that if it's not practical to do that, it's not practical. You got to say what you mean and mean what you say. And that is true. It's just that I think it will lead to a more positive focus on the group. But that's and Jen and others are saying that your expectations are usually lowered when you modify your expectations, even if it's still a positive expectation. that your expectations are usually lowered when you modify your expectations, even if it still remains positive. You had a very high expectation coming in. You expected issues to really be resolved and to get towards rather an ultimate goal, and you have had to reduce, lower, as Jen and others have called it, your expectation to meet a practical goal. You know, that's, you know, William says it's not, you're not lowering them. You become more compartmentalized as the issues go, as you go issue for issue, step by step towards resolution. See, it's a good point. He's saying that you don't really, you're not lowering your expectations. You're not giving ground, but you become more compartmentalized as you go issue by issue and step by step towards resolution. That you have come with an overall expectation that as you work on it, and a lot of people are agreeing with this, that as you work on it, it becomes less obvious exactly that you can get the big goal and you need to get smaller goals and get successes on the issues. That's a very good point. I am getting quite a few people. Thank you very much for all of your participation. I'm getting quite a few people that are calling in. We don't generally take phone calls during this show because it makes it extremely long. And the questions and the issues and like that are generally talked about during the show. So thank you very much. Please do send in the questions and other items. It's just because it makes the show extremely long, and we try to make it within an hour so that my audience, so that you guys don't lose interest. It's kind of like, yes, we will get to your question. It'll be great. And because we've got a whole bunch of people that are participating, and generally the same questions do come up. I name people, but they are representative of what a lot of people have been saying. So thank you very much for everybody that's calling in. Please, we don't generally do live calls just because it makes the show extremely long. And really, you're going to get sick of hearing from me for that long a time. So we try to make it within the hour. But thank you very much. And thank you guys for all of your participation online. You know what? I've got a lot of people asking an interesting question. And so I think it's going to be our next one. We have talked about expectations like they are something, and goals, like they are something that we form in a vacuum, that we form individually for this group and only this group. But a lot of people are asking, how does belief enter into the equation? How does your cultural, religious, social background, how does your personal opinion, really, enter into the equation for what is an expectation that's reasonable, an expectation that's practical. I mean, you can have an expectation of any sort, but it's got to be something you can do, right? It's got to be viable so that we can reach it, so it's a goal. So how does our belief system, our underlying opinions, enter into, and what should we be careful of when we create an expectation towards consensus, right? And, you know, Kelly and others are saying that it makes modification of the expectation more difficult because usually based on long-held opinions. And maybe even people are saying not only long-held opinions, but kind of, well, I'm going to paraphrase it and say kind of unconscious opinions, the opinions that we don't even think we have. It's just our idea that's the way the world works, right? Our opinions and our beliefs enter into the equation of the kind of expectation we have. And, you know, Daniel and others are saying that belief is not really based on the individual facts, but on assumptions. And that you need to deal with the individuals in the group and not on any kind of pre-existing idea. Belief is not usually based on facts, but on assumptions. And we all do that, don't we? We make assumptions, we have expectations about how people act and about how the world works, really, kind of, don't we? And, you know, people are saying yes, and they've got, and usually they're cultural, social, or religious. And a lot of people are using the word bias. And we have talked about bias and stereotype in the past and other shows. And Kevin says it depends if the belief, and he has capitalized it and put it into quotes, is really a bias or a stereotype. Now, that's an interesting point, isn't it, that we need to be careful of. We need to be careful of our own beliefs and make sure that they are not really a bias or a stereotype concerning the issues, maybe even concerning the people involved in the issues, and concerning their backgrounds, their cultural, religious, social, whatever kind of background. And we need to be careful of ours, that we're not basing our expectation, basing our goal on something that has not that much to do with this specific group and these specific issues. And Laurie says that your belief needs to be based on personal opinion or observation, not a generic belief created by others in order to be a valid expectation. Not a generic belief created by others. See, it has to be your personal opinion, your personal observation, which gets us back, yes, I see the people are saying that gets us back to the fact that they voted no, that you're not supposed to come in with an expectation because you can't have a personal opinion or observation yet because you haven't dealt with these people. And, you know, we have made rather a circle, haven't we? And that's a very valid point. And, you know, and people said that you have to go halfway through before you can Elizabeth said that you needed to get halfway through before you could make an expectation because you had to have a personal opinion and a personal observation of the people, the issues, what was going on. So it's an interesting point, but at least you should have an expectation based on facts before you have an opinion that is not based on a bias or a stereotype, especially one that was given to you by others, family, religious leaders, cultural bias, that kind of stuff. And Nell and others are making an interesting point. They basically say that you cannot avoid bringing in your opinion and your background. And just as others in the group cannot, you just need to be fair about it. She says that you can have a belief based on religious, cultural, and social standards, but you need to be open-minded and practical in your expectations. Open-minded. Now, that's a really good statement. We need to be open-minded. We need to remember that we need to use personal observation and personal opinion based on the people, the facts, the issues. We need to be open-minded, even if we have made an expectation based on a belief that is religious, cultural, or social standard. But you need to be open-minded and practical in your expectations. And you know, quite a few people, and I'm going to paraphrase this, I'm going to say what Sarah said. You know, there's an expression, and I know that this is a global show, and it's kind of an American expression, but the expression is easier said than done. Have you ever heard that expression, easier said than done? Yes, we can say this, but we need to really think about it and whether or not our expectations have not been formed open-mindedly, because if not, we're going to be rather disappointed. And, you know, it's people are saying that you need to be constantly self-aware to prevent your expectations from bordering on bias or stereotype. And it's a good point. You need to think about these things. You need to think about whether you've been open-minded in your expectation and whether it is a reasonable one, given the facts that you have at any given time. And that's why expectations and goals become modified as we go further. And yes, and Raymond or others are making a very good point that we make with some frequency on this show, that whenever you're mediating, you need to be not only self-aware, but also aware of the reactions of the other people. So you need to look around. You need to not only be aware of and cognizant of the fact that you need to be open-minded and that you're going to modify some expectations, but you need to look around and see what others are thinking and listen. That's a real key to all of this. And Max says you need to be flexible enough to recognize the expectations and biases of other people in the room too. Yeah, you need to look around and to listen and to think, well, let's see, what is our expectation, what is our goal, and how are we going to achieve it? And really what we're trying to find out is how we can avoid unreasonable or biased expectations. And a lot of people are saying that the key is the observation of the people around the table and their interaction with each other. Observation of interaction and thinking about what people are saying. I'm very big, and I know that a lot of you are, and a lot of you are was using the word listening. And yes, you need to listen to the other people. And yes, and people are asking, are we going to talk about food? We are. We're going to talk, and this is a good segue, because of course, Recipe for Peace Now, one of the things we advocate, right, is not just to sit there and talk to each other, at each other. You need to talk to each other in a convivial atmosphere. And the reason that we use a potluck and make the convivial atmosphere with some food usually is because it gives everyone a way for a time out, a way to sit back and think. And it gives people a moment. Most people's reaction when they need to be flexible, when they need to modify their expectation, is no, right? That's the knee-jerk reaction. No, I'm not going to do that. You do that. You modify. You concede. But when they think about it, everybody's giving a little and taking a little, and it gives, if you have a convivial atmosphere and you can take a break, a pleasant break, it gives people a moment to take three deep breaths and think. And also, talk to the other people that share their same interests. And so it's not because we're hungry, really. It's not really a food thing. It is a negotiation idea. It is a convivial atmosphere idea. It is a networking idea, if we must use that word, because that's an overused term, networking. At least it is in the States, but that's the idea of it. And now, all those of you who have been before, thank you very much for coming again, and those of you who are new. But everybody, I always say this before we talk about bringing a potluck dish or having a group together to eat. It is very, very important that you have everything labeled, because people have allergies, they have dietary restrictions, and they have religious restrictions. And we don't want anybody to get sick or offended or distraught in any way. The idea is to make, of course, a convivial atmosphere. And that's, you need to have, you tell everyone in advance. You email them, you call them, however you're communicating, and you ask them to please list the ingredients. It doesn't have to be the recipe, but the ingredients in the dish that they're bringing. even if they didn't make it, they need to know the ingredients, because people need to judge whether or not they can eat it. And not only are we going to label it right in front, not just the name of the dish, but what's in it, but we are also going, as the host, you know that I always think that we should have some extra food, just in case somebody doesn't bring, they bring too little, whatever. And I always like to have a safe dish in addition to something that I call an adventure dish. And the safe dish is something that has familiar ingredients, and it is something that most people are not allergic to, have a dietary restriction or a religious prohibition from eating. Now, you will, of course, have asked everyone. Excuse me, I was putting on my glasses so that I could actually read the recipe. You will, of course, ask everyone in advance about their restrictions, but still, so our safe dish tonight is something that doesn't have too many ingredients, and they are fairly common, at least in the States. Now, I have been asked by quite a few people to make the safe dish a little easier and less time-consuming to do. So I'm going to talk about using cans of product, because these are cans that are easy. This is a global show, and if this is not something that is easy for you to come by or very expensive, then you will, of course, substitute. And, of course, I'm going to use chicken, because chicken is easy for me to come by, inexpensive, and most people do not have a prohibition against chicken. So this is the safe dish. You can substitute any kind of a meat-type object. You can make a vegetarian if you would like. You can use tofu. But, of course, everything needs to be cooked and properly seasoned. And I always say drained, because if you've got something that's awfully wet in consistency, it will not do this recipe much good. So our first one's going to be a cornbread chicken casserole. Very delicious and very popular. So we're going to start with 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 2 tablespoons of oil, 6 boneless, skinless chicken breasts that we're going to cut into chunks, 1 package of taco seasoning mix. That is easily gotten where I am. They actually sell it as taco seasoning mix, those little envelopes. If not, it's the spices that you would use in a taco. And not too much of it. It's maybe... those little packets are maybe 1 tablespoon. It's not, so if it's not a little package, it's about 1 ounce. The 1 package is 1 ounce of seasoning. So think of it as that. 1 can of black beans that we're like a 16-ounce can that we're going to rinse because they're gooey when you take them out of the can. So I always run them under water. And also you get rid of the extra shells, the extra skins that are in the can. And we're going to rinse them and drain them real thoroughly and pat them dry. We're going to have 4 tomatoes that we're going to dice, 1 can of corn that we're going to also drain very thoroughly. There is such a thing in the States as Mexican-style corn. It has little peppers in it, little diced red peppers and green peppers, and it's a little more spicy. If you like to have something spicier, you have to think about your clients. You know, you have to think about your guests. But it's not terribly more spicy, and it is pretty. I kind of like to use the Mexican corn. And we're going to have 1/2 cup of salsa. I make it myself with just tomatoes and onions, and everyone knows who's listened to this before that I really like garlic. So I just make a really basic salsa. If you're going to use the jar kind, so the 1/2 cup of salsa, drain that also. Everything needs to be kind of drained for this recipe so that you don't have it squishy when you go to spoon it out. And there's an 8-ounce box of cornbread mix that is quite popular here. And if you need an egg and like that, whatever it says on the box. So we're going to have 1 box of cornbread mix and about 1/2 cup of cheddar cheese. Okay, so we've got all of this, and as I've been asked, I've got quite a few things that I used a can for, and the box of cornbread mix. If you don't want to use the box of mix, just make a basic cornbread dough. We're going to preheat the oven to 350. We're going to spray or grease a 2-quart casserole, maybe a little bit bigger even. And now we're going to take the oil, we're going to heat it up, and we're going to cook our chicken nice and thoroughly. You know that I think everything should be cooked rather thoroughly before we mix it in. So we're going to take our cubes of chicken, we're going to cook them until they're really cooked through and they're done. We're going to take the taco seasoning, we're going to sprinkle it over the chicken, we're going to add the beans, the tomatoes, the corn, and the salsa, and we're going to stir it all together. This is a very easy recipe. We basically speaking are taking everything except the cheese and the cornbread mix and mixing it together after we've cooked the chicken. And then we're going to put all of that into our dish, into our casserole dish. Now, we're going to make a crust, right? We've got, this is actually a very pretty recipe too, if I may say so. We've got the beans and the chicken and the salsa and like that underneath. On the top, it's a covered casserole. We're going to make a crust, essentially speaking, just on the top of cornbread so that when it's done and you take a serving spoon to it, you cut through the cornbread top into the bean chicken salsa-y type bottom, and they come up together, and it's delicious, it's pretty, and most people really like it. So we're going to take the cornbread mix, and we're going to prepare it, whatever it says on the box, or we're going to take a basic cornbread dough recipe. And we're going to, because it will be delicious when you bake it, I like to add the cheddar cheese, the shredded cheddar cheese at this point, about half a cup of shredded cheddar cheese, just a couple ounces. It's just not too much, but it'll make it very delicious on the crust, very delicious. And we're going to take this batter that we've just made, and we're going to spread it over the chicken mixture. Then we're going to bake it for about 30 minutes until the cornbread, because everything else is really cooked underneath, right? So it's the cornbread that needs to bake. And we're going to bake it for about 30 minutes until the cornbread crust is lovely and golden brown. There we've got it. And some of you know who have been here before. A lot of you have been here before. Thank you. But I always think that before you set something out to serve, you should let everything stand for about 5 minutes to settle so that when you go to cut into it, it's a little firmer and also less burning hot. So we've got the chicken and salsa and bean bottom. We've got the lovely cornbread cheesy crust. We're in. We're done. We've baked it for 30 minutes. We're going to label this, even though it has some really basic ingredients. It's got tomato. Sometimes people are allergic to tomatoes. Or, you know, you've got to label it. But that is going to be our safe recipe for today. Now, we're going to go for an adventure recipe. Now, the adventure recipe is an adventure one, for the reason being that it's bacon meatloaf. It is a very basic meatloaf recipe. I've been asked to do a little bit simpler recipes, but it does have bacon in it. If you have people with a prohibition, you can leave the bacon out. It does give it a nice salty, gives it a bacon flavor. Let's face it, it's nice and salty and got some grease to it and like that. And also, I personally think that half ground beef and half ground pork is a nice combo for a meatloaf. And I know I should call it a pork loaf, eh? People are going, that's not a meatloaf. Well, all right, but when you get all done, it looks like a meatloaf. But that's why we are labeling it, right? Right. Because you wouldn't expect it. It's called a meatloaf. It's called a bacon meatloaf, but it's got pork in it. It's got bacon and pork. You don't like that? Leave out the bacon. Just make it with beef. I mean, it certainly is going to be delicious. It's just that I think that the bacon and the pork add another dimension to it. And I suppose I've gotten used to it, let's face it. So we're going to have a half pound of bacon that we're going to cook. Or sometimes it comes pre-cooked, but we're going to take a bacon, we're going to cook it and chop it, make little tiny pieces. Especially this is why you need to label, because you've just put something in that's not obvious. That's why it's the adventure recipe. And we're going to take a pound and a quarter of ground beef and a pound and a quarter of ground pork, one onion minced, two garlic cloves crushed, 2 cups of breadcrumbs. In the States, you can get breadcrumbs pre-made in a canister. I personally like flavored breadcrumbs. I like Italian flavored ones. They have some parsley and some Italian seasonings in them. So if you're going to use plain breadcrumbs, maybe a little bit of seasoning would be nice. Yes, whatever you like, a little bit of parsley. One egg lightly beaten, it'll keep it all together. And I like a tablespoon of red wine vinegar. It gives it that little extra piece of tartness, but that's, of course, something you need to label, right? Right. Okay. We're going to preheat the oven to 350. And we're going to, I like to line my meatloaf tin, my baking tin, because it keeps the meatloaf from breaking when you go to take it out. It's just a trick that I learned from my grandmother. And I line the pan with a couple of sheets of baking paper, and I leave the baking paper over the edge of the pan so that when you put the mixture, when you put the meatloaf in, it'll shrink somewhat, right? It's not going to stay the size of the pan exactly. But when you go to pick it up to get it out, you just grab the paper and you transfer your meatloaf to a dish. Whoop, plop, in one piece. And you don't have to kind of get something underneath it to get it up out of the pan. And you don't have to do the dreaded upside-down pan thing, which makes, of course, the meatloaf grease and juice and everything that's come off of it get all over the place. So this is just a trick that I always do with meatloaf is I put a piece of paper underneath it. So we're going to take our bacon, we're going to cook it, and we're going to chop it, right? And we're going to drain it. We've already known to do that. Then we're going to take our meat, our pork, our onion, garlic, breadcrumbs, the egg, the vinegar, and the bacon, and we're going to squish them all together. Personally speaking, I like to do it in a big pot with my hands because if you use a food processor, I've seen people do it, it will make the meat, we're going to call it a meat mixture, but I know it's got pork and bacon in it. It'll make the whole mixture kind of finely chopped. It won't have a, when you go to get it out of the pan and slice it, the slices won't be as nice. So I think you should take everything and mix it by hand. Just squish them all together so that everything's incorporated. You put the mixture in the tin, in your pan that you've lined with the paper. You pat it all down so you don't have cracks, right? And we're going to bake it in the 350 oven for about an hour and a half so that it's all done and all hot and cooked through. Same rule about when you go to serve it. It's the rule, I like this rule, before I take the paper and get it out, let it sit for 5 minutes. When you're all done. This is an easy recipe. We've mushed everything together. We've put it in the pan. We've baked it for an hour and 10 minutes, hour and 15 minutes. It's nice and browned. It's beautiful. It's pulled away from the sides because it's shrunk somewhat. Give it 5 minutes of rest before lifting it out so that it's firm because you'd like it to slice firm. But that's it. That's our lovely meatloaf recipe. Is it meatloaf? Well, we're going to label it, right? Because not really. It's a bacon meatloaf. It's got bacon and it's got pork in it. It's also got a little bit of red wine vinegar. Sometimes people are allergic to that. And it's got some garlic and some onion. Well, that you can expect. And you will, of course, also say whatever it is that you have seasoned your breadcrumbs with so that people don't get a nasty surprise. That's the idea. You want them to have a good time. That's why it's a convivial meeting. Yes, it's good. So, we have actually come to the end of another one of our shows. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you for coming back. If you would like to hear more shows, the last five are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. All of the shows are archived at the radio station, blogtalkradio.com. www.woodrecipe.com/recipe for peace now. And if you would like to find us, woodrecipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. Thank you very much for listening. I always learn something. I hope you have too. And please do come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.